Hi, and welcome to the Sports Info Solutions Baseball Podcast. I'm Mark Simon. March is Women's History Month, and I wanted to honor that while still having the kinds of conversations that are typical of this show. So our theme today is Women Who Analyze Baseball, and I think each, in their own way, is shaping the future of how baseball is covered. We're first joined by Chelsea Janes, the national baseball columnist for the Washington Post, and we'll talk all things baseball with her. Then we're joined by Andrea Arcatapane, who goes by Scout Girl Reports on Twitter. She talked about her experience of working in baseball operations for the Yankees, gave us a few players of intrigue, and showed by example how to communicate some baseball concepts and terms effectively. And then we close the show with Sarah Thompson. Sarah is a research analyst here at SIS, and she'll talk about a presentation she did at last week's Saber Analytics Conference. Lots of advice and perspective shared, too, so let's get to it. Chelsea Janes is the national baseball writer for the Washington Post. She's been with the Post for nearly 10 years, a good chunk of that covering the Nationals and then the national scene as well. Chelsea, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So when we interview major leaguers, we typically ask them to recount a defensive play for us. When we interview people who cover baseball, we don't necessarily do that. But in your case, we make an exception because you played 4 years of college softball at Yale. Do you have a most memorable defensive play, whether it was there or otherwise?
I do, yeah. I think it was from my high school days when I was playing shortstop, and there was a slow roller between the mound and first base, and I don't know where our second baseman was, but I knew no one was getting there, and I ran over and flipped to first, and everyone thought that was the greatest thing they'd ever seen. So I got a lot of praise, and I will always remember feeling like I was the best defensive shortstop that had ever been, simply for thinking, oh, if someone else isn't going to get that, I probably should. But yeah, it's the key. Just do mediocre things in front of easily impressed people. And that's how I've made my name.
Now, you were a catcher. Were you a good pitch framer?
You know, I like to think so. I definitely was I had a good arm. That was like my only skill. I think I was like second in the Ivy League 1 year in runners thrown out, and I only played half the game. So that was I think I lulled people into thinking I was worse than I was. So yeah, I had some defensive prowess for sure.
Nice. We appreciate that. That's our big thing on this podcast, certainly. Through a few weeks of spring training, what sense are you getting regarding the new rules? We can touch on the three big ones. First of all, the pitch clock.
You know, I think that we saw the exact amount of whining I expected to see, but in general, I think that the reviews have been really good. I think everyone's realizing how much better the game is with it, at least in terms of, you know, the ability to watch it, the ability to sort of endure it. You get less of those games that just make you think, why am I sitting through these pitching changes? Why am I sitting here? And I think the WBC has helped too, because some of these games have just been so long, and you look at it, you're like, oh, this helps, you know, this makes this more pleasant. So I think the reviews on that one have been pretty good, and the people who are going to whine about it have and will continue to, but even the players, I think, are kind of realizing like, this is good. This is good for the game.
Were you surprised? I'm guessing you weren't surprised to see what Max Scherzer was doing, trying to mess with people, right?
Right. I mean, no doubt. When I talked to him about it early last year, he was like, I hate it. I can't believe they're doing this. You know, it's terrible. And within months, I think he had changed to, I mean, I manipulate this for my own purposes, which I think is kind of classic baseball. So yeah, no surprises there.
Did anyone else say anything particularly interesting about the pitch clock to you in the list? A few weeks?
You know, not really, actually. I think the main thing is just like people are realizing it's not that hard to deal with. And that's been the thing.
And how about moving to defense? Might as well talk about this. Oh, shifts.
Yeah, this one, the jury's still out, at least for me. I haven't heard a whole lot of people drawing conclusions yet, which I think is probably smart. I think the one thing I continue to hear from people, and I'm sure this is not novel, is if you have a good defensive shortstop and a good defensive second baseman, all of a sudden that becomes a far more, you know, noticeable advantage maybe than it did when you were able to shift. And so, you know, you get to those balls in the hole or whatever it is. And I think that has been everyone's big conclusion so far. But, you know, I think until we see April batting averages and see some of those guys we expected to be helped by this, it'll be hard to tell. You talked about Scherzer. I wondered if he sort of gave it away too soon. So I'm curious if some teams are holding things back until the regular season.
Yeah, that would make sense. What about the limit in the number of pickoffs for pitchers? We're starting to think that that's going to have a pretty decent sized effect.
That's really interesting. I haven't seen the numbers, which I'm sure you have, but I was asking people about that last week. And one thing Aaron Boone said actually was, what we're noticing is that teams are paying more attention to how they hold runners to sort of, you know, deal with that. And as a result, it's sort of putting, it's having a little bit of a reverse effect that he noticed in terms of pitcher focus on runners and just the way that, you know, teams are trying to get guys to get better at holding runners on. Whether that will actually matter numbers wise, probably not, but I thought it was interesting. But that's another one where I'm not sure everyone sort of knows what to think, but I asked Trey Turner, who you would think would love that kind of thing, be able to steal a few extra bases. And he said the thing that he's noticed is he doesn't have to dive back to first base as often. You know, I think it was Clayton McCullough, the Dodgers first base coach last year, he said, looked up how many times Trey Turner had dived back as opposed to anyone else in the league. And it was like, you know, 170 to 100 for the next guy. And he said that wears on you, you know? And so I think for him, you know, it's just a little less wear and tear, maybe on, you know, who knows how that sort of manifests itself, but it seemed fairly significant to him. And I hadn't thought of that at all.
I suppose the injury aspect of it and the wear and tear on the body, we've talked within our company and we've done some studies on the idea of diving, sliding, and jumping for fielders and how it's on our list, not necessarily at the top, but it's on the list of things that impact injury-wise. So that's kind of one of those hidden things that, yes, again, we might not think about. All right, so transitioning here, in terms of interesting teams this year, you've written about two multiple times in spring training. One is the Padres. The headline on one of your more recent ones was the Padres are baseball's most fascinating experiment. You wrote about Peter Seidler, their owner, and his willingness to be kind of Steve Cohen-ish, I guess, so to speak. I like to think of it as shiny toy time. You buy a team and you have to buy some shiny toys, like in Texas when they gave A-Rod this, you know, the crazy contract that he got. San Diego's got a lot of them. What do you make of their spending?
I think it's a huge problem for other teams in similar markets in a good way, sort of, for baseball. I mean, I think it's interesting to hear Rob Manfred say things like, well, is this sustainable? And for people on that side of the game to float that question, because I think, you know, the answer that we sort of all know is it's sustainable as long as you're willing to sort of maybe lose money, maybe lose $10 million a year to win, maybe, you know, not have this be a cash cow. And that is something that other owners don't want to hear, because one of the things we sort of hear from small market owners a lot, and we heard it during the lockout, is should we be expected to operate at a loss to win? Should we? And whether you believe that they are doing that or not, we obviously don't see the books for most teams. It's hard to discern. But I think by and large, if you look at these teams and you're willing to sort of spend enough that you lose money for a couple years, you know, you can do that and win. And Peter Seidler seems willing to do that. He might lose $10 million this year. He might lose more than that, but he might win. And long term, you know, the revenue comes back and the interest in his team jumps. And it's an interesting approach. He's all in on it. And I think it will sort of inform us moving forward about what's possible for those markets, you know, seeing how not sustainable, to use the Manfred word, but just to see how it plays out, to see whether the money that he puts in ends up coming back to them, ends up, you know, being worth it financially, if not certainly on the field. It's just a really interesting approach to something that, you know, we've heard small market owners complain about for years. Like, I can't make money and win. It's like, well, which do you want to do? And Peter Seidler has sort of emphatically said, I want to win, and we'll see where it takes us. And I'm eager to see where that goes.
Yep. And the one thing that's different about his situation to Texas is I think he's used his money to buy a lot more depth. Plus, they have the farm system to kind of supplement what they've already got. Now, you mentioned small markets, and we come across the country, other side of the country, team you've written about a couple of times this winter, which makes sense because you're in Washington, they're Baltimore. The Orioles, they didn't spend. They stuck. They had a rookie, and they'll get a full year out of Gunnar Henderson. They've got more rookies coming. It's got a big pitcher coming in Grayson Rodriguez. They're betting on Adley Rutschman to jump to superstar mode. They're betting that Cedric Mullins is going to be pretty strong again. But it is funny because when you compare, like, the Orioles and the Padres' ace is Yu Darvish, who is on this loaded Japan team at the World Baseball Classic. And Baltimore has found an ace, and a guy who's actually pretty decent, but he's the ace of Team Israel, Dean Kramer. What should we make of the Orioles?
I don't know. You know, I'm curious. I think that they, too, are an experiment in themselves, which is to say, I think that the rebuild that Mike Elias has overseen there, very similar to the Astros, but a little bit different, is sort of like, can we really do this? Can we start from scratch, spend nothing, and make this team a winner? And certainly, I think, you know, he'd probably be fine if John Angelos said go spend. But the way they approach this offseason they're not eager to do it. You know, they want to see what they've built here, which I think, you know, walking around that clubhouse is, it is not something I've ever seen before in terms of just the names and the prospect numbers and just the sheer number of people that you look at and say, you know, this guy could be a superstar, or, you know, his pedigree is such that he could be a superstar. And, you know, I think they're just going to wait one more year and see who's who. And it's a gamble, because as soon as you find out who's who, everyone else does too. But it's really interesting. And I think, you know, it's hard to know what they're going to be. I mean, it's like, you know, I wrote this, but I feel very curious about it. If you're not looking at the back of baseball cards here, you're not looking at guys who have done it before. You don't know what their ceiling is. We don't know if Adley Rutschman is a fluke or not. We can guess, but we have no idea who these guys are. And if they're as good as, you know, everyone has always thought they are, that's a pretty good team. That's a team that's going to be good for a long time, and maybe it works. And if they're not, that's kind of going to be interesting to watch them sort through too. So, you know, I don't know what to expect from them. I think in that division, it's always tough, but it's really hard to say where they end up. And I think the range of outcomes for them might be as wide as anyone in baseball.
The range of outcomes for that whole division is pretty amazing. Yes. When you think about it. Do you have a favorite story, player or team, heading into 2023?
That's a really good question. I'm interested in the Rangers purely because I think they've sort of sneakily, but maybe not so sneakily, but over the years put a ton of money into that team, put a ton of sort of thought into their coaching staff. You know, they've done the weird bench coach rollout of, you know, assistant manager, whenever, you know, brought in hires, brought in Donnie Ecker, brought in, you know, anyone you could think of to sort of revamp their big league coaching staff in the hopes of turning another, you know, pretty deep system into something, you know, at the big league level. And it just hasn't caught, hasn't even come close. It's been too top heavy. It just hasn't worked. So I'm just eager to see what they do, because they seem sort of in this weird limbo too, where, yeah, it's just that's an interesting team for me. I think it's sort of off the radar for most people, but I've just been interested by what they could do there and what they have. Other than that, I, you know, for me, I think Ohtani is the most kind of fascinating case study. We'll see whether he comes out of the World Baseball Classic, you know, messed up by it in some way. I mean, some of the swings he's taken, I'm like, oh, you know, it's like the home run derby in the All-Star game. You know, you're just kind of like, just don't mess up your swing. Don't do that. You know, how that tournament changes his perception of what he wants. I mean, this whole year could be fascinating. And if the Angels are out of it in July, I mean, the mess that could ensue at the deadline is just absolutely fascinating. So that's my story.
As I think you kind of wrote, he's going to, if they're out of the race, he's going to get bothered at whatever city he goes. You want to come here? You want to come here? You want to come here? That sort of thing. All right. What's something that could happen this season that could surprise people?
That's a tough one. I've been thinking about this. You know, I'm kind of eager to see how the NL West shakes out. I think the Dodgers might be worse than they've been in a long time, but every time I think that, they're not. But I don't see the pitching depth. It just doesn't seem to be kind of happening there, you know? So we'll see if they drop off. I'm really interested to see if the Diamondbacks make the leap that they seem to be ready to make. Are the Padres as deep and as good as they seem to be? You know, that whole division to me is, it's not quite the AL East, but I think it could be a little bit more fluid than we've been used to in the past. And for me, maybe it's just kind of, you know, that the Dodgers as new evil empire attitude, but I'm just sort of curious to see what happens if the Dodgers aren't the Dodgers and there's sort of this vacuum out there and, you know, they've been good for so long. Do they finally sort of have to hit a reset button and be just average or better than average for once? That's kind of something that I'm eager to see.
There's potentially a huge difference there between the fourth and fifth place teams as well, because the Colorado Rockies are going to have to play all those teams, and I think they're in for quite a long season.
Yes.
And the quality of those other teams is significantly different. One Nats question, because we're taping this on Monday, I watch on Sunday night, I see Joey Meneses go bonkers in the World Baseball Classic. There's going to be a couple of days in between when we tape this and when this airs, things might change, but what the heck should we make of him?
I don't know. You know, I don't think the Nats know. I mean, he's, you know, all winter, it's like, well, you know, they've got Joey Meneses, like, who knows? You know, it's kind of like they don't even know what to count on there. They brought in Dom Smith. That's somebody who's going to take a lot of at-bats at first. You know, I don't think they know, but everything they've seen so far is real. Everything we've seen in the WBC is real. You know, to do that against the American pitching staff, I think gives it more credibility. He's just so easy to root for, but I don't think they're planning on him being the guy he was from August 2nd on last year, but they don't you know, that you can't, but they're not ruling it out either. They just have no idea. Maybe this guy just figured it out and he's that rare guy and the feel-good story they need. I think they're crossing their fingers, but I don't think you bring in Don Smith and say you're going to play a lot and, you know, all that if you are positive, but who knows? They'll find space if they, you know, they've got plenty of room for somebody to hit on that lineup. Yeah.
You were talking about teams with the greatest variance. You could make a case that he's a player with the greatest variance this year in terms of just the range of outcomes for him. We'll see. All right. So I want to segue to another thing that I wanted to talk about with you. I just got back from the Sabre Analytics Conference. One thing that they do there are panel discussions. I think in total there were 4 baseball writer, editor people there. 2 of them were women. Hannah Kaiser at Yahoo, Meg Rowley at FanGraphs. No one thought twice about it. Sports Illustrated, 2 of the 3 most prominent baseball writers are women, Stephanie Epstein and Emma Baccalieri. The national baseball writer at the Wall Street Journal, Lindsay Adler. Your national writer at the Washington Post. At MLB, one of the executive editors is Allison Footer. I could keep going. I could list a lot of baseball beat writers as well. This is Women's History Month. The theme of the show is talking to women who analyze baseball in different ways. A little history here for the 10 years that you've been doing this. How has the landscape changed for women in terms of who want to do what you do these last 10 years?
I think it's dramatic, actually, the change. You know, I think when I started covering the Nationals, I was lucky because there had been a female beat reporter before me. That definitely wasn't true for every clubhouse. And I think that, you know, there had been women doing television and sort of coming in with a camera. And so in that way, the players were used to having women around, but it's more polished, as you know, when you're kind of dealing with TV people, it's, you know, when you're just kind of in there and the cameras are off, you know, that's a different world. And I think in the 10 years since I've kind of been in clubhouses, it's become a lot more normal to see other women in there. I mean, just so much more normal. We've been joking about it even, you know, Hannah, Lindsay, Steph Epstein, you know, Britt Giroli. I mean, I think at one point we were all in one clubhouse and it was just funny, the conversations we were having about, you know, they were just conversations I'm sure had not been heard in a clubhouse before. You know, I think, you know, baby Steph and it just was funny. And I think we all kind of like slowly realize like, oh, wow, this is new. This is unprecedented for all of us to be here. So, you know, I think in a lot of ways, too, the climate has adjusted to be more accommodating. You know, you could argue it should have been more accommodating to start with. But I think that for a long time, clubhouses were, quote unquote, safe spaces for the players to be whatever they wanted to be. And I think, unfortunately, in some cases that included, you know, overt misogyny or whatever you want to say. It was just kind of locker room talk, as we know. And for many reasons, but I actually credit Stephanie Epstein a lot for this from Sports Illustrated. It's like, that has no longer been okay. You know, we saw in 2019 when, you know, Brandon Taubman, the Astros exec, sort of implied he didn't care about domestic violence when regards to Roberto Osuna and yelled at some women in the clubhouse and Steph and others wrote about it and said, like, this is not a safe space for you to just be a jerk. I think that was meaningful because it was like, we're here too. You know, we deserve to feel safe here. You know, there's no safe space to kind of be sexist or misogynist or anything like that. And I think in the years since, you've heard a lot of executives change the way they talk about these things. You know, the sexual assault cases, domestic violence cases, everyone's just a little bit more aware of the, you know, the way the system has been for years. And it's noticeable. It's noticeable in the way executives talk, in the way that we're all treated, and just in the sheer number of women that are around. And everyone you mentioned, it's always fun to see them. It's just like a great little sign of progress that I think we sort of don't necessarily notice all the time, but when we do, it's really meaningful.
What do you tell women who want to do what you do about how they can best pursue it?
You know, I think this is the best time to do it. I think people are trying to sort of find, no offense, but the non-traditional white guy baseball reporters now, you know, they're kind of looking in places they haven't looked. And so this is the time to kind of do that. And there's a lot of really good young reporters around too. Katie Wu, Kennedy Landry at MLB.com. I'm missing millions, I'm sure. But, you know, I think that if you want to be in baseball, and that's not just, you know, in a writing capacity, I think it's true across the board. Like, this is the time to throw your name in the hat, to assume that you can do the things the guys can do. It's, you know, the walls have been broken down for people that didn't play baseball to be in front offices, to be in decision-making roles, to be in my job. And I think it's a kind of perfect time to just go for it and try to be the most qualified person for the job.
going back to how the landscape has changed, how far does it have to go? And what's something that could happen this year that would be significant progress?
You know, I think it's got a long way to go still. I think, you know, Kenning being the only, you know, GM in baseball is, you know, stuff like that. The executive roles, you know, we've seen managers, we've seen sort of, it's still a story, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, when you have a woman in a baseball decision-making capacity. And I think we're getting to a point where that is no longer true, but it's still definitely true. And one of the things that is frustrating sometimes is, like, for example, when you know, if you kind of read between the lines on Kenning, or, you know, she surrounded herself with a lot of Yankees guys, and you know, you just hear people, you know, falling like, who's in charge? Is it that guy? Is it this guy? It's like, no, it's her. Like, she is a woman in charge of this team who is making the decisions for this team, and there doesn't have to be someone else. She is fully capable of doing that. So there's just kind of these assumptions in the way people talk in the business about women in those roles. You know, we saw Rachel Balcovich manage in the Yankees system, and even that, it was like, oh yeah, she's the one who can handle it, you know. And it's like, well, no, like, more than one person can handle it. You didn't find the one person who can do that. You found someone who can do it. And so I think just kind of like normalizing and realizing, you know, that everyone needs to be taken on an individual basis, and all those things that we know about when it comes to sort of breaking these barriers, they still have to sink in. But I'm encouraged for sure by the fact that people are making these hires. We're seeing people kind of all over the sport. I think something that could happen this year, I don't know. I hope if the Orioles do well, that Eve Rosenbaum, who's Mike Elias's sort of number two and a really big presence in that organization, kind of gets her due. It's sort of a role that she kind of ascended to quietly, but is going to make a lot of noise in, I think, soon. And so, yeah, I think just everyone sort of settling into those jobs that they were groundbreaking in, and being able to do them in ways that sort of earn them normal baseball respect is I think what we want to see moving forward.
Normal baseball respect. I like that. All right, last question. Who's winning the World Series this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the Astros. I don't know. We'll just see Luis Garcia Pedro. Like, are they, who beats them? I don't know. They could get whoever they want at the deadline. So I'm just going to take that easy route, but I hope something crazy happens. I really do. I always do.
Yep, me too. All right, Chelsea James, Washington Post baseball writer. Thank you for taking the time to join us. Best of luck at this season, and we'll be following.
Thanks for having me.
You can follow Chelsea on Twitter at Chelsea_James. So when I was reading that list of women baseball writers to Chelsea James, there were a lot of others that I left out. Some of my former colleagues, Sarah Langs, now at MLB, Marley Rivera at ESPN, Shakia Taylor at the Chicago Sun-Times, or a few more. And then there's our next guest, Andrea Arcadapani, who's better known as Scout Girl on Twitter, just finished a one-year stint as a baseball operations associate with the Yankees and has made a name for herself with videos and graphics on social media. Hey, Andrea, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to establish who you are a little bit more. You're from New York City, Northeastern grad, went to school to study or eventually studied civil engineering. You interned for the Rays outside of baseball ops. Can you just walk us through your baseball interest?
So I was obviously a big fan of baseball growing up. When I was in college, they had a co-op program, which was a 6-month internship. And I was a structural civil engineering major at the time. So I wrote them a letter about their new ballpark and some ideas I had, and I ended up working for the Rays for 6 months during college.
So that's pretty different from what you're doing now, and there are two components kind of to what you've done recently. There's the Scout Girl component, there's the Yankee component. You worked for the Yankees. Let's take that first. You just spent a year with them in their associate program. What was the experience like?
It was a great experience. I had the opportunity to work on a lot of different things like arbitration, player evaluation, prospect rankings, advanced scouting, playoff advance. So it was a busy year, but I learned a lot and it was a lot of fun.
So which area that you worked in was the most interesting of those?
I thought prospect rankings and player evaluation, especially of the younger prospects, was the most interesting just because there's so limited information out there in the public that to have more information to get the opportunity to see those players and learn from scouts was really valuable.
So like, what was a typical couple of hours working on that like, without getting into any names?
I guess it would start by like doing my own research on the player, watching video, looking at their stats and all that stuff, and then just talking to others in the office on the more analytics heavy side, and then others on the pro side to get feedback and talk about our different opinions.
So I would imagine that for something like that, it's like a completely different form of baseball education, right? Especially when you get into the terminology and language, really in both worlds. What was that like?
It was really valuable to me because I really didn't have like a mentor or anything leading up to this point. So it's very difficult, I think, to self-teach yourself that, especially like the slang that they use, like that coaches use, that scouts use, all that stuff. So I thought it was an incredible opportunity to learn from people who use that kind of terminology every day.
So what was the most difficult thing that you worked on?
The most difficult, I think, was playoff advance, because there was a lot to do in a very short amount of time, because we really had no idea what team we would be facing in each round. So we had to prepare for every possible playoff team. So it was a lot of quick turnarounds, but it was very exciting because we were in the playoffs and we got that opportunity to compete.
So what were you looking for? Were you looking for, like, I presume there were some areas where you were looking for advantages, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I had like certain things that I would look for, and I would mark down like strengths and weaknesses of the other team and things that I thought we could take advantage of.
What's the collaborative process like?
It really depends from project to project, but I think that like they in general do a good job of incorporating all opinions and not focusing so heavily on like just analytics or just scouting. Like they like respect everyone's opinion and they try to mesh it all together. So it's a lot of just like talking to different people. Like we all sit together. It's not really like there are separated groups or anything like that.
How much did you have Brian Cashman's ear?
He was actually very friendly and he walked around a lot to strike up conversation. So there was one time, like when I first started, that we bonded over our mutual love of Mamma Mia, like just like things like that, you know, but he was very nice and he was very transparent.
And the Yankees certainly have a very large analytics staff. I know that they have this associates program. I've come across other people that have worked in it. What kind of advice would you have for someone that wanted to work for a team?
Just to read and research a lot, keep an open mind, work hard, work consistently, and honestly just hope for the best, because it's not an easy industry to get into and it's not an easy one to stay in.
And the hours are pretty challenging, right?
Yeah, we make a lot of sacrifices.
All right, so let's go to Scout Girl. Now, Scout Girl kind of sandwiches your Yankees experience. You made your mark, so to speak, with an explainer about Ryan Yarbrough's arbitration case loss that certainly was very well received on social media, but you also do more evaluative type things. What exactly are you trying to do with your videos, write up some graphics?
I really just do whatever I feel like doing. That's first and foremost. My goal is to just have fun and share my passion for baseball. And like I said before, I know from experience how hard it could be to start watching baseball and learning the intricacies of it without help. So I just want to make content as beginner friendly as possible and to help translate some of those advanced topics to more casual fans in what I think is a fun way.
You said beginner friendly, and that kind of struck a thing with me in that I watch your videos or I read some of your analysis and I think, well, that's about as easy as you could explain it to someone, whether it's the terminology, whether it's the Ryan Yarbrough case where you had some graphics to back it up. Just curious, where did that come from?
Well, I guess like when I first started, and I had no one like reading my stuff. It was a lot of my family who doesn't watch baseball. So, and I think that is ultimately what helped my videos stand out a bit, is that they're easy to comprehend for anyone. And it's something that I think people appreciate, because it's easy like in social settings on Twitter to feel embarrassed about asking questions. But baseball is just supposed to be fun, and it's supposed to be something we could all enjoy and talk about. So I don't like overcomplicating things. Like, the simpler I can get the message across, the better.
I got the sense, too, that the Twitter perspective on it, they had your back kind of from the start. Like, your Yarbrough video was very popular. And if you go through, and I don't know what you got in terms of messages at you, but in terms of the replies to your video, they were all extremely positive.
Yeah, they were very positive, thankfully. And that was the first video that actually got watched. And it was because some of the writers at D-Rays Bay found it and they were, I guess, retweeting it. And then it got noticed by people with, you know, huge followings. That helped out a bit. But I mean, all the feedback so far has been like, thank you for explaining this in a simple way. Like, I get messages sometimes that say, like, I'm trying to get into baseball, and this is the storytelling that you do is like a nice way to translate like advanced data to like a coach or a more casual fan. And I've gotten that feedback from teams, from players, from managers, coaches, like all different people in baseball. So I figured I must be doing something right.
Well, it's awesome. And it's a great example of set for others that want to do it, as you're talking about. So how do you, all right, you kind of already alluded to this, but how do you formulate your opinion on a player or a team?
It just stems from watching games and asking a lot of questions. And then from there, just researching to see if there's anything interesting that comes up from answering that question. So like with the Yarbrough case, it was, why did he lose? Like, I didn't know anything about arbitration. I went to the collective bargaining agreement and it basically outlines how to do arbitration in there. So then just making a video on that. Or like the other day I was watching Randy Arozarena and I noticed his swing looked different from last year. So I made a little note. I looked at the differences in the videos and turns out he is changing something. So it's just like keeping an open mind, like paying attention to everything, like new pitches, new swings, like all that stuff, and just taking notes and going back and checking later on.
Does a civil engineering background come in handy in that?
It must. I figured it does. Like, I'm very detail-oriented, so I'm sure that's part of it.
So let's dive in. Let's see a few players. And I liked, we discussed, essentially, you told me who you wanted to pick. And I liked your choices because I liked the idea that they weren't necessarily top radar people. Who's a hitter that you find particularly interesting for 2023?
So I picked Vinny Pasquantino. Kind of came on the scene this year. I've seen some other people talking about him too, but he's got great power, great hard hit rates, great awareness of the barrel. He doesn't strike out that much. He has above average plate discipline, meaning he can walk. So he just has a really good and well-rounded offensive profile.
When you mention awareness of the barrel, what does that mean?
Just bat to ball skills. So can he hit for average, I guess, would be the scout way of saying that. Like, does he have a good feel for like not just making contact and making contact on the place on the bat where you want him to?
So one thing that I've noticed too is bat to ball skills is a very popular one for you. That
yeah.
the idea of it is really pretty simple. You like players that make contact. And I can yeah. tell that you study your contact rates pretty hard, right?
Absolutely. Because like at the end of the day, like I want a hitter who could hit the ball. That's like a very basic threshold for me. So obviously power hitters are great too. There's a time and a place, but I think that a lot of contact hitters go under the radar.
One of the things that you'll notice if you go through Andrea's Twitter feed a little bit is you'll see references to that. You'll see there's a chart that goes back a little ways with the Dodgers and how little they chase. And you basically walk through it player by player of all the players that had these great chase rates, which was certainly a story for the team last season. All right, pitcher-wise, so you went with someone on the Minnesota Twins, and I thought you would go with Yoan Duran, but you didn't.
No.
and this is admittedly, pitchers who were interesting for 2023, I would not have picked a mid-30s left-hander, but you did, so who you got?
I picked Caleb Thielbar. I think you could have picked anyone in the top four at the Twins, and it would have been fine. But I picked him because he is flying under the radar. He has above-average control. He's got a four-seam curveball combo versus righties, and then versus lefties, he adds in the slider. But the four-seam has plus ride. The curveball's slow, but it has a lot of depth, and the slider is very sweepy.
Yeah, explain the ride and the depth.
Ride is just like a typical movement for a four-seam. It just moves north, and his has above-average movement in that direction. I think the curveball depthy, so if in your head, imagine like a 12 to 6 curveball, one that goes straight down, and this one has that motion. And when a curveball is thrown slower, like his is, it's going to have more of that naturally. And then the sliders move typically east to west for a righty, so or west to east for a left-handed pitcher, and his gets a lot of that horizontal sweep,
certainly,
like a frisbee.
And the sweep is going to be something that I think is going to be more paid attention to this year with some of the advances on Baseball Savant. Now, us being a defense-first podcast, defense-oriented here, we asked you to pick a fielder, too. And there are a couple of guys that are intriguing watches this year that are changing positions or playing a position more regularly this year. And you've got one that you were particularly interested in. Who was that?
I picked Adam Duvall for the reason that you said that he's switching positions to center field. But he's fast. He has an above-average arm. Did play center field a bit for the Braves, if I remember correctly, and he did fine. DRS had him as an average center fielder. And I do think that he looks like an average center fielder. Like, I don't think he's going to do anything incredibly, but I think he'll like make plays and do fine, which says a lot for someone playing center field, I think.
Yeah, especially at age 34.
Yes.
therein lies the challenge for him. If you go back and look at the list of guys the last 10 years to play center field, age 34, like Brett Gardner did it recently. That didn't go particularly well. Gerard Dyson did it strictly because the Diamondbacks needed it. He didn't hit. It's a challenging thing to do. Also, just to plug something that we've done in the past, Andrew Kine did a study for us like 3 years ago about corner outfielders moving to center field and looking at like, all right, is it a 10-run left fielder? What is that guy in center field? And that's, you essentially stated it, he's a zero. He's an average center fielder. The difference, I think, equates to like an 8-9-run drop going left field to center. We'll put that article in the show notes. Got one more for us? Any that fits any of the three categories?
Yeah, I'll pick another pitcher. Left-hander Brandon Walter, who's a Red Sox prospect. They protected him in the Rule 5 draft. But I think he's unbelievable. Today, he was optioned to AAA, so he's not in the rotation anymore, or not in the rotation competition anymore. But he's got a really strong pitch package, plus control. He gets a lot of strikeouts. His two-seam has plus sink. The downward movement is sink. Very sweepy slider, again, that gets depth. And his changeup has above average fade, which is the horizontal movement. So he does have some tough competition to enter the rotation, but I think he'll get a few spot starts.
In a year that the Red Sox are, according to most, somewhat in decline, it wouldn't be surprising for a guy like that, who has, the one thing that I picked up on, an amazing strikeout-to-walk ratio, is it wouldn't be surprising for a guy like that to get an opportunity. All right, so cool. So we got Pasquantino, we got Duval, we got Thielbar, and we got Brandon Walton. So a complete package.
Cool.
Who's winning the World Series this year?
The Astros.
2 for 2. Chelsea James picked them as well.
Nice.
All right. Why?
Well, because they're just an amazing, well-rounded team, and they have good depth.
Yep. I think that's a perfectly reasonable pick for this year.
Yeah.
So you go kind of chalk-ish on your World Series pick, even though you don't necessarily go chalk-ish when I ask you for players who are interesting, which is great. Andrea, a.k.a. Scout Girl, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
In talking with Andrea, one of the things I pointed out was that she had a knack for explaining things. And I think that came through in particular when we were talking about stuff like evaluating ride on a fastball. And we've talked about baseball education in the past with Jake Stone at Penn State. It's the same thing we talked about with him. If you can explain it easily, it will make you a valuable person in the baseball community. Andrea is sharp at that. You can follow her on Twitter at ScoutGirlReports. Our third guest presented at the Sabre Analytics Conference for us for the second straight year. Her presentation was about measuring defense in the minor leagues, specifically outfield defense. SIS research analyst Sarah Thompson joins us. She's one of our leaders in executing a variety of projects, whether it be writing code, making apps, or doing general research to better our work. Hey, Sarah.
Hey.
So your presentation was about minor league outfield defense. What specifically were you looking into?
Yeah, so the essential part of that research was implementing the PART system for our minor league outfielders. And some background on that is basically at the minor league level, we've been able to split infielders' positioning credit from their range credit within defensive runs saved. And that's important so that infielders don't get punished for being positioned poorly, which we assume is on the team or the organization for where fielders standing. And basically now we can perform that same range and positioning split on minor league outfielders now that we've been collecting their positioning coordinates for a couple of years now.
So this is pretty significant because it allows us to look at outfielders a little more closely and a little bit more in depth. And it allows us to, as you have articulated here, essentially to better our numbers. And one of the cool things about your work was that there was good practical application to it. You showed some examples, specifically with a couple of guys that played last year, Michael Harris and Christian Pache. What did you find about them and in terms of how their minor league numbers compared to their major league numbers?
Yeah, so this was kind of an interesting part because we only have this data for like 2 years and there's too many guys that like have been in both levels a good amount. So we really focused on like Michael Harris and Christian Pache for the presentation. And Michael Harris was a good example of a guy who is liked by both minor and major league DRS. So in 2021, he led center fielders in the minors with 5 part runs saved. And on a per 1,000 inning basis, it's about 10. And in 2022, in major leagues, he had 6 runs saved, which on a per 1,000 inning basis is 6. So basically, he looked good at both levels, and I think that also agrees with most people's like eye test of him.
Yeah, it was cool that the numbers were able to convert so easily. What about Christian Pache?
So Christian Pache, so he was interesting because minor league and major league DRS kind of disagreed on him. So in the minors in 21, he had -5 runs saved, and that is comparing to a major league center fielder. So he's below average of a major league center fielder in the minors. But in 2022, in MLB, he had six runs saved above average. So he basically looked good in major leagues and poorly in minor leagues by DRS. Although that kind of, the minor league evaluation kind of disagrees with what most scouts have said about his range. And so we looked into that, and basically he really struggled with plays that are basically caught like between 55 and 65% of the time in the majors. So he struggled with those plays in the minor leagues, but he did really well on those plays in the major leagues, which kind of explained a decent chunk of that discrepancy in his numbers.
So a little bit better than 50-50 balls, kind of like balls that he could have caught. He wasn't necessarily catching in the minors, but he was catching within the small sample in the major leagues, and that allowed him to have, as you articulated, good numbers. So the most interesting part of your talk to me was when you compared minor league and major league out rates on balls. This was kind of cool. It was like, all right, there's a fly ball. You're going to tell us what the minor league number is in terms of how often that ball gets caught. And then you told us the major league number in how often that ball gets caught. Can you give us a couple of examples there?
Correct. So I'm going to frame these balls in relation to how far they were away from where the fielder started and how far they were in the air for. So basically for left fielders, the biggest like gap in minor and major league performance on the similar balls was when a left fielder had to run 90 feet straight back on a ball that was in the air for over 5 seconds. And in the minors, that was caught at 56% of the time by left fielders, and it was caught in the majors 85% of the time by left fielders. So that's
huge.
Really a 30% gap right there. It's pretty significant. And that's not a ball where like we only had 10 plays. Like I made sure to like look at balls that had significant sample in both minors and majors. For center fielders and right fielders, they're actually on the same kind of ball. So also traveling 90 feet, which is interesting, but this time moving laterally and on balls in the air between 4.2 and 5 seconds. So not as quite as much hang time as the left field balls. And center fielders caught these in the minors 55% of the time compared to a major league out rate of 87% among center fielders. And then right fielders on those same balls in the minors 46% and 79% in the majors. We would expect, you know, right fielders to make that play a little less often than their center field counterparts.
So that's really kind of, I don't want to say crazy is not the right word, but if you just think about it in your head, like, especially I like the center fielder one, 90 feet laterally. So that's a pretty good sprint for a major league center fielder, but the ball's in the air for a decent amount of time. And that running catch that you see made by the center fielder in one of the gaps, whether it's right center or left center, I don't want to say nonchalant, but it's a fairly comfortable play for them. Whereas you really see at the minor league level, what a difference. Less than half the time that ball gets caught. So that's pretty cool. I like that you were able to do that. So we were both at Sabre Analytics. I think we both found a number of other presentations pretty cool as well. What did you find interesting?
The presentations that were interesting were, I'd say, MLB's presentation, where they talked about weather information that they were going to begin to incorporate, and also new bat tracking information. I found that particularly interesting because I didn't realize like modeling weather in that way was such a big lift, which, I mean, I'm not going to describe the lift they did for that, but it's pretty in-depth and they've done a lot of good work to effectively model that. And I'm not sure like how much of the bat tracking stuff we as the public are going to be privy to, but I'm excited to hopefully learn from those insights eventually.
Yep, that from the folks at MLB. There were a number of other pretty good presentations. Our VP of Baseball, Bobby Scales, did a talk with Dallas Braden and Kyle Glazer of Baseball America about the new rule changes and how they might impact the game. We'll talk about that more with Bobby in a couple of weeks. Last question. What advice would you have for a young woman or student who says, I want to do what she does, as in you?
So first and foremost, love your domain, whether it's sport or something else. Probably secondly, ask questions and answer them with research projects. And most importantly from that is showcase them, put them on the internet. You know, don't worry that you might look stupid if you didn't do it well. Like, you just want people to know that you have work out there and you care about something, and then you're curious and trying to answer questions. And thirdly, don't be afraid to fail. Ooh, and one more. Strengthen those written and verbal communication skills. We learned that a lot at Sabre too.
Yeah, Rebecca Kaleri-Kosmarczyk did a very good presentation on the difference between presenting a research paper and presenting to someone that works for a major league team. So that was cool. Sarah's presentation was good as well. Sarah, who's winning the World Series?
Phils. Phils is right. Four.
Nice. So we got Astros, Phillies from our three guests today. Sarah Thompson, thanks for joining us. And this wraps up the Sports Info Solutions Baseball Podcast. You can follow my guests on Twitter, Chelsea_Janes, Scout Girl Report, and Sarah_Stats. For Chelsea, Andrea, and Sarah, I'm Mark. And thanks for listening to the Sports Info Solutions Baseball Podcast.
Thank you for tuning in to the SIS Baseball Podcast. If you like the show, please rate and review us on iTunes. If you have any questions, email the show at mark@sportsinfosolutions.com or tweet us at sportsinfo_SIS.